BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, it's 744 days since Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and we're days away from Russia's presidential election, which we already know the outcome of, don't we, Vitaly?
We absolutely do, and a lot of people are asking if it is going to change anything. No, it's not going to change anything at all. Vladimir Putin is going to win, and he's going to stay in power for at least another 6 years. But this election matters hugely to one man, and that's him, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin, because it's a way of legitimizing his rule, continued rule. When he gets elected, he will feel more emboldened, even if he needs that, because he's got everything under control. That's why these elections are held, to create an illusion of democracy.
And in the lead up to that election, we'd love to hear from you. Your questions, your thoughts about what's happening in Russia right now, you can send us an email, ukrainecast@bbc.co.uk, or you can send us a message or voice note. The number is +44 330 123 9480. In today's episode, we are going to talk to a woman called Fiona Hill.
She's advised three US presidents. She made headlines back in 2019 when she testified against Donald Trump during his first impeachment. And she's met Vladimir Putin on a number of occasions.
She really is a Russia expert. And her fascination with the country, as you'll hear, began when she was a young student. She is perfectly placed, because she used to work for President Trump, to talk to us about Mr. Putin, about Russia, and the prospect of a second Trump White House. And she has some interesting insight into Mr. Putin himself, because she sat next to him twice at a dinner.
This is Ukrainecast.
Ukrainecast from BBC News.
Ukraine is an epicenter of unbearable heartache and pain.
Millions of people are without heating, without water.
Putin is the aggressor.
He will be ready to use nuclear weapons.
They killed him and fled.
I do not know how we managed to survive.
I want people to know the truth.
Hello, this is Victoria Derbyshire in the Ukrainecast studio.
And this is Vitaly Shevchenko, also in the Ukrainecast studio.
And let's talk straight away to Fiona Hill, who is in Washington, D.C. Fiona, welcome to Ukrainecast.
Well, thank you so much, Victoria. Hello to you and Vitaly.
Thank you for being with us.
If I may describe what's in the background, because we can see you, there are family photos on the shelf behind you. And also there's a picture of Red Square in Moscow.
That's
and also,
right.
I think, a picture of Russian, was it Soviet sailors?
Well, it's Soviet sailors, actually, ironically enough, because I wasn't really thinking about this ahead of this podcast, because this is the kind of thing that's always on my shelf over here. These are a couple of pictures that I took when I was a student in the Soviet Union, because I am so old, back in 1987, 1988. At that point, Red Square had barricades for people going off to see Lenin's tomb and didn't have what's now a kind of a church and a gateway that's been restored at the front of it. And the picture below is actually of a group of sailors from the Black Sea Fleet in Odessa.
Oh,
so
wow.
That's actually quite apropos of the moment that we're speaking of. I've had these on the shelf for years, and you know, I never really thought about it until you just said.
No, not at all. It's and that shows how many decades your fascination with Russia stems to. But what ignited that fascination?
Well, it was actually the Euro Missile Crisis of 1983, and I feel like we've gone full circle, you know, 50 years on, to say it, as a teenager, you know, really worrying that we were going to end up in a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. And I was growing up, obviously, in the UK at the time, and there was very much that sort of sense that we were facing annihilation. You know, in short, it was a pretty fraught time. And I thought, well, I'll study Russian, try to figure out, you know, why they want to blow us up. And here we are.
Here we are. I remember listening to President Putin's State of the Nation speech a couple of weeks ago. And he said Russia's nuclear weapons are in a state of complete combat readiness for guaranteed use. Does that mean the world is a safer place now than before? Is it less safe compared to what we just recalled?
Well, in terms of thinking back to the Soviet period, in some respects, this may seem ironic, and it's, you know, based on all the things that I've figured out over the last 50 years, we might have been more safe because, you know, the Soviet Union was a bit more of a rational actor, and I'll talk about, you know, that a bit more. I mean, I think, you know, in many respects, Putin's trying to go rogue. And there was the beginning, the period when I started to study Russian, of the big arms control negotiations, you know, later on by Gorbachev and Reagan, later in the 1980s, in fact, exactly when I was a student in Moscow in 87, 88. But this idea, obviously, of mutual assured destruction, MAD, as we used to think about it. And there's a great deal of very cautious maneuvering around each other. And as I said, we start to move towards major arms control negotiations. And, you know, we have the Politburo, we have a lot of checks and balances in the Soviet system. Fast forward to now, and we don't have those checks and balances around Putin. There's a vertical of power. Putin very willfully engages in pretty menacing nuclear rhetoric. And Putin has, you know, very recklessly talked also about using tactical nuclear weapons on the battlefield in Ukraine, not because of any existential threat to Russia as the Soviet Union feared from the United States, but just because he's kind of losing or has been losing previously on the battlefield. But I do want to also say that the world is a very different place from what it was in the 1980s. Back in the 1980s, there were five permanent nuclear powers. And throughout the Cold War, you pretty much, for the most part, have these five states dominating nuclear discourse. And of course, France and the United Kingdom have a pretty small nuclear arsenal. China's stays quite static for a while, but has recently started to build up. But in the meantime, we have other countries pursuing nuclear weapons. Now, while that's made the world seemingly a lot more unsafe, particularly from the point of view of nuclear proliferation and all these other actors that could go nuclear, and lots of other countries talking about getting nuclear weapons, it's also proven to be a bit of a failsafe or a check on Vladimir Putin. Because, Vitaly, as I think you're alluding to, not just the recent statements from his equivalents of the State of the Union about being locked and loaded with his strategic nuclear arsenal. As I mentioned, Putin has actually talked in very strong and loose terms about using tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine. And on the occasions that he has raised that, he's had a massive pushback, not just from the United States or the UK and France, but also from China, which is now a major nuclear power and rapidly building up an arsenal, but also from India and from lots of other countries who would like to make sure that nobody crosses over that nuclear threshold again, including Japan, which is the only country that's ever had nuclear weapons used against it by the United States, of course, in World War II.
Let's talk about the Russian elections then, because we're a week away from the presidential election. The pendulum seems to be swinging towards Russia on the battlefield in Ukraine. Obviously, Alexei Navalny is dead, Putin's most high profile, most prominent critic. How strong is President Putin right now?
Well, look, obviously, in many respects, he's pretty strong, certainly going into his election. He doesn't really have anything to worry about there, apart from perhaps the turnout and general apathy. Or, in fact, maybe even resistance to voting for people who are basically very unhappy about the war. Because although, I mean, as you're suggesting there, Victoria, Putin looks pretty strong on the battlefield in respect to how he's looked at previous points, of course, the special military operation has not really succeeded in the way that Putin envisaged, or anybody else envisaged, for that matter, in Russia. They thought Ukraine would capitulate in the first few weeks. And they certainly didn't envisage a massive war on the scale that we see, which is, you know, basically the largest military conflict Russia's been engaged in since World War II, far exceeding what it even was embroiled in as the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, for example. And we see a lot of dissatisfaction about the war. There was an alternate candidate, a man named Boris Nadezhdin,
yes,
who had obviously got permission from the Kremlin to run. His name means hope.
We've had him on the podcast.
Yeah. Oh, you did? Oh, right. Yeah. Okay, I'll have to go back and listen to that one. But anyway, Mr. Nadezhdin didn't have a hope in hell, as it turns out, in terms of being even a candidate in the campaign. But he got, you know, 100,000 plus signatures. A lot of people looked like they were about to support him. I think also the fact that you had so many people come out for Alexei Navalny's funeral. Lay flowers at memorials despite the high repression and the real risk of being arrested, and people are still facing that. And Alexei Navalny had called for people to vote in an act of protest at 12 noon on March 17th, on the very last day of the voting. We haven't got there yet, and we'll have to see what happens, whether you do get a mass swelling of people coming out. But there are signs there that despite
is that going to change anything if they turn up and just stand there or cast their votes?
Well, it obviously doesn't change anything at all, Vitaly. That's kind of really sort of the point of what Vladimir Putin is banking on. But what it does show is that there is a deep dissatisfaction and frustration with the state of play in Russia. And in fact, that people are willing to make acts of protest. So we'll have to watch that one very carefully. And it'll make a difference to Putin, at least psychologically and symbolically, because he will in fact know that there is quite a bit of dissent. And what Putin wants in this election is a re-anointment, a reaffirmation of his role at the apex of the political system, essentially as a modern-day czar. He's basically been telling us with everything that he's done, including the death of Navalny, that there is no one but him, there can be no other, and that he is prepared to be president of Russia, possibly out and most likely if his biological clock is ticking that long out till 2036, because he can have two more six-year terms. And by that time, he'll have exceeded his time in office. People like Catherine the Great and the czars that have preceded him, and also
and
Joseph
Brezhnev.
Stalin, who was and Brezhnev and everybody else you can think of. So exactly, that is a major symbolic point. But you're absolutely right that as far as Putin's concerned, that really won't make a vast amount of difference to his hold or grip on the political system, unless it starts to get people around him questioning, you know, his position.
You're right.
I just need to take one second.
No worries.
I think we can see the tail.
Ah, yes. You're just letting your dog
I'm
out.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to open the door because is
not
pounding on it.
I guess
the mention of Vladimir Putin's too much for the dog.
What's your dog called?
Lola.
Lola. I also have a dog called Lola. Do not worry. We're used to dogs and babies on this podcast, so everybody is welcome. Our listeners will be fascinated to hear what your impressions of President Putin are. You've met him multiple times. You sat next to him at an official dinner where you were able to observe him closely. What was he like? What is he like?
Well, he's very tightly controlled. I sat next to him twice, in fact. And I mean, right next to him. Obviously, he leaves nothing to chance. They must have profiled me and decided that I was the least likely person to stab him in the neck with a fork. Although I have to say that it did cross my mind that I was sitting, you know, so close to him with all these potentially dangerous implements. If I had been a highly trained assassin, that wouldn't have been a really good place to put me. But that's actually one thing, is that Putin tends to disregard women, by
really?
The way. I mean, he's pretty misogynistic. Mm-hmm. And this actually fits into what he's like, because I was very curious as to why I was sitting next to him. On the other side of him was another female, his press secretary. But at one of the times when I was sitting next to him, I was the national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia at the US National Intelligence Council. You know, so I have these sort of, you know, Judi Dench's M fantasies going through my mind. You know, I wonder if he's playing with me politically.
Yeah.
You know, is there some purpose for that? And it's just purely because I was a nondescript middle-aged woman and nobody would be looking at me on the television screens and wondering who I was. They probably thought it was his press secretary. And so all eyes would be on him. Any man who could have looked vaguely interesting, you know, was sitting at some distance from him.
Right.
So
you were not considered a threat?
No, I wasn't a threat. And in fact, I wasn't even a distraction.
Right.
I was just a piece of, you know, kind of tableware.
Right.
And framing for the great man himself. And so what I mean is everything is orchestrated from him. I also sat close enough to him that I could see that he wasn't wearing contact lenses. You know, no sign of any kind of infirmity. People are always saying, oh, he's had plastic surgery or Botox. There was nothing in that particular era that I could see specifically, because I did obviously take the advantage of having a very close look at him. But what I did notice was that all of his cards, his prompt cards for the event, were in huge font, so I could read them as well.
Right.
And he made a point of actually covering them over, which might have thrown him off a little bit because he realised I could see them. And that, of course, showed me that just like the rest of us over 40 at the time or over 50, you know,
our eyesight goes a little bit.
His eyesight goes right. Yes. He could have done with a pair of specs.
Yes, gosh.
Which I could do with two. But anyway, it was all fortunately in very large font. And of course, all of the cards were prompts of who the people were, so that he would look incredibly well informed about everybody.
Understood.
And when he moved the cards, he actually mixed up two people and threw onto, you know, kind of a few points about their biographies that were not pertinent to them, and, you know, caused a bit of confusion. So it also shows that he's not infallible.
Yes.
But everything about him is closely controlled. Everything is highly orchestrated. He's always thinking about the setting, always about how he's presenting himself. He doesn't leave a lot of things to chance. And he's not chatty, as one can imagine.
This might be a weird question, but did he eat or drink anything?
He did not, which made me worry too.
So why not? Is he worried about being poisoned?
Well, most likely. And in fact, at one point, a special cup of tea was brought for him where the cup was brought out. And actually, in retrospect, I discovered and realised from some photos at the time, the person serving all of this was Yevgeny Prigozhin.
Wow, we've seen those pictures. We've seen those pictures. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was taken aback. Well, I was actually gobsmacked. I was like, oh my God, that was Prigozhin. It
yes.
hadn't even, as you said, Vitaly, it was his chef, but it hadn't occurred to me in real time. I didn't obviously at that point know who he was because this is, you know, quite some time ago.
Yes.
In other meetings that I've been in the government with Putin, I've been in a couple of those where we've been at the big table in the Kremlin, the big white table that has become infamous because of him sitting at one end and everybody else 2 miles away at the other end. And those times pre-COVID, I think the table leaves had not all been put in, smaller kind of size of the table, it would be opposite. And again, you know, he would have his notes, but the whole, you know, atmosphere that he wants to, again, convey as a guy of a man in charge and everybody else in his team being fairly superfluous. You know, he'd be across the table, he'd be in charge, he'd ask every question, he wouldn't bring in, you know, even his defence or foreign minister. A couple of people would be feverishly taking notes, but what I'd noticed was, you know, for example, Lavrov and Shoigu, the foreign and defence ministers, were doodling the whole time. So obviously, you know, their roles in, Lavrov apparently doodles quite frequently in meetings, but it just shows that their roles are inconsequential and that everything really comes down in conversational terms to Putin if he's in meetings like this.
Okay. Let's talk about the impact that this year's presidential election in the United States could have on the war in Ukraine. Have a listen to Donald Trump on CNN last year.
If I'm president, I will have that war settled in one day, 24 hours.
How would you settle that war in one day?
Because I'll meet with Putin, I'll meet with Zelensky. They both have weaknesses and they both have strengths. And within 24 hours, that war will be settled. It'll be over. It'll be absolutely over.
So this week, Donald Trump was all but confirmed as the Republican candidate. If he does win, what will this mean for the war?
Well, it obviously doesn't bode well, does it? That statement, of course, by now I'm and many others are very familiar with it. It's pretty much like many statements he's made in the past. When I was in the administration, he was always bragging about his abilities to negotiate, to sit down with people and to get them to do things that they didn't usually want to do. He talked before about mediating between Russia and Ukraine. He was always offering himself as a mediator in conflicts because, to be frank, and he made this also very clear, he was very interested in getting credit for some kind of peace process, getting the Nobel Peace Prize. He was also very interested in sitting down with Russia and with Putin and redoing the 1980s peak of arms control negotiations in a Gorbachev-Reagan-esque fashion. He talked about that frequently. That was one of his obsessions. But when it comes to Ukraine, Trump has very little regard for Ukraine. He shares Putin's view, and Putin's reinforced this over time, that it's not a real country. You know, he often opined that if people spoke Russian, they were clearly Russian, despite the fact that, you know, of course, a very large swathe of the world speaks English and isn't all English. But, you know, for Trump, you know, he had really processed there that Crimea, for example, or large swathes of Ukraine where the Russian speaking should probably be parts of Russian territory. So one would imagine that that would be, you know, one of his starting points, Donbass, Crimea to Russia, then, you know, perhaps work the rest of it out. He's talked about using various points of leverage, including US assistance. One comment from people around him in the campaign, as this campaign, for example, has been that he would use the promise of more US assistance, although, you know, right now we can't see that getting through the Congress, but anyway, the promise of more US assistance to persuade Zelensky and Ukraine to negotiate. And for Russia, similarly using that, saying that basically if Russia negotiates, the United States won't offer Ukraine assistance so they can work things out. He's just basically betting on the power of his own personality and charisma for getting them to decide things in 24 hours.
So your view is a Trump presidency would be not good news for Ukraine and would be good news for President Putin?
Of course, because, yeah. I mean, what Putin would really like is, in fact, the United States to basically push Ukraine towards capitulating. Mm. If we look back towards the special military operation, the full-on invasion 2 years ago, after 2014, when Putin annexed Crimea and there were a whole host of accords spearheaded by the Europeans, the Minsk Accords, he was always trying to get the US in. Because Putin believes that Ukraine and all of Europe are, in fact, vassal states of the United States. He wants to have a rerun of the big three, but in this case, the big two summits from World War II, where they would meet in Yalta. And in fact, he has Yalta now under his possession again. So perhaps Yalta, somewhere like this again, to basically divide Ukraine up. And in fact, he'd like to have a broader division of spheres of influence in Europe, just as Stalin got out of Churchill and Roosevelt.
And Vladimir Putin, as you will know, Fiona, recently said who he would like to win the American presidential elections. Let's have a listen.
Biden. He's more experienced. He's predictable. He's an old school politician. Although we'll work with any US leader the American people put their trust in.
Why do you think he said that?
No, he's trolling us in large part. But he's also, of course, signaling that he'd love to have a deal, and he believes that, you know, Biden is a deal maker in the sense that he's predictable, as he said there. Somebody from, he put the emphasis on starry, on old, from the old, you know, system, the old style. But ultimately, I think Trump is really the preferred candidate for Putin in so many ways because he is an agent of chaos.
I've heard so many speeches made by Putin in the past, almost 24 years, that it's really difficult to get rid of this feeling that he says something, but he actually means the opposite. As a KGB officer, former KGB.
Yeah, every time he says, no, I'm not going to invade, you know he is, or I'm going to kill this man, and you know that he's going to do that. And in the case of Trump, he really thinks that he can manipulate Trump, and he's actually shown that he's quite proficient at doing so. He can play to Trump's vanity, for example.
Why does Donald Trump admire Vladimir Putin so much when in the end, Mr. Putin would probably quite like to wipe the US off the face of the earth?
Well, I think it's just what you and, you know, Vitaly are circling around here. And, you know, Vitaly has pointed out, Putin's been in place now for 24, 25 years. Mm. We're in his port of a century. And, you know, for someone like Trump, that's kind of what he wants to be as well. He wants to be the anointed leader. Mm. You know, the Russian term is the vojt, you know, it's the supreme leader. I mean, he's got very strong authoritarian tendencies. We all see that. He's talked many times about how he should just be waved into power, how he should have, obviously, he perpetrated a coup to stay in power, or an attempted coup to stay in power after 2020. And for him, Putin is the iconic strongman leader. That's how Trump sees himself. He sees Putin as his peer. And, you know, people like President Xi as well. It's not about Russia. It's not about China, obviously. Trump has been quite critical about China. And frankly, during the Trump administration, he allowed people around him to be pretty tough on Russia. There's a, you know, kind of a strange contradiction there. It's because his admiration of Putin is divorced from whatever he might think about Russia.
Would you work for Mr. Trump again if he were to become president?
I absolutely would not.
Why not?
I mean, I have no regrets about doing it the first time around. I think it was the right thing to do under the circumstances of Russian interference. And you know, that's obviously why, you know, I joined the administration, was asked to join because of my work on Russia and knowledge of Putin. But, you know, this time around, we need unifying figures in the United States at this point, not divisive figures.
Moving over to Europe, let's have a listen to the French president, Emmanuel Macron, who was speaking on a visit to Prague.
We are entering a moment in the history of Europe in which it will be required that we are not cowardly. We never want to see the tragedies to come. We never want to see what's at stake. I think both our countries are aware of what is unfolding in Europe, the fact that a war is being waged on our territory, that powers that have become unstoppable pose bigger threats each day of attacking us. We will have to be up to this historic challenge and the courage that it calls for.
And he also did not rule out the possibility of Western troops being deployed to Ukraine. What's going on? Is France, is Europe trying to fill this possible void left by the States?
Well, Macron's certainly trying to fill it rhetorically here with these very bold statements, as you're pointing out, but, you know, action is needed. he's talking about something in many respects in that speech that seems, you know, close but still far off, where we're in the here and now of a hot war, the biggest land war in Europe since World War II, with millions of refugees. And this is a full-on crisis. And the whole of European security is at stake, which he rightly points out. It's not just about Ukraine. It's about the whole future of Europe, because Putin's threatening all of that. So it's not just a question of fine words from Macron. And it's really serious action here. And I mean, basically, this is a moment. It is one of those moments, very sadly, where we have to stand up. And the United Kingdom as well has a pretty critical role to play here. In fact, the UK has led the charge with Ukraine of signing a bilateral security agreement, which has got a whole lot of other countries doing the same. The Ukrainians see these as, you know, pretty fundamental to their security. These are a kind of a grassroots effort of trying to help Ukraine. They're not necessarily an Article 5 trigger or Article 5 type trigger of a kind of mutual defence pact, but they're moving in that direction. And the more of these bilateral treaties that Ukraine has, you know, the better. I mean, the big question really is about how Ukraine's security is managed over the longer term, because obviously Ukraine has to be able to show to Russia that it can fend it off. But so does Europe. And that's where the whole debate is now.
So yes, what can be done? You say now is the time to stand up for Ukraine. How?
Well, other countries have to take the leadership, I'm afraid, you know, because if we're all sort of standing around and just waiting for Macron to say things, it's not going to happen. And I think the Brits in already doing these bilateral treaties, the Finns and the Swedes, now that Sweden's in NATO, going to have opportunities to make moves forward. There are lots of discussions that are going on, not just at NATO, but sub-regionally as well. It means a different way of arming ourselves. There's a debate now about increasing European military production. I mean, I hate to be saying all of this, having started off in the hope of studying Russian back in 1984, that we'd end up in, you know, peaceful coexistence with Russia, which is not where we are. But, you know, this is the reality that we're dealing with. We're going to have to rebuild our militaries in ways that we didn't think we did.
Just got a couple of more questions, Fiona. I know I'm aware of your time. I just want to be clear. In your view, does a Trump presidency make the likelihood of a Ukrainian defeat in the war more likely?
Well, it does if everyone's just waiting around for the United States. But I think this part of the discussion is don't wait. And I think, you know, part of the problem has been that Europeans have been relying on the United States for too long.
Let's end with this question from one of our Ukrainecast listeners.
Hello, Ukrainecast. My name is Derek and I'm from Dublin. My question is, when and how do you see the war ending? Could it be through an uprising in Russia? And even if Russia loses in Ukraine, what is stopping them from leaving Ukraine, only to come back stronger down the line when they are properly rearmed?
I mean, that's an excellent question. I like the way that he put it into, you know, three different parts there. Because, I mean, I think this war ends when Putin's calculation changes, because right now he thinks he can win. So, you know, if Europe doesn't stand up and doesn't make good on all of these commitments that it's made, yeah, I mean, the war will probably end by Ukraine being forced to capitulate and losing more territory than it might otherwise as a result of Russia having the upper hand. But we can also foresee an end to this war in which Europe's security mechanisms and networks and its whole superstructure becomes pretty robust, that Europeans show Russia that no matter how Russia is building up its military industrial complex and, you know, trying to refurbish its military for all the equipment that it's lost, Europe can meet that and then some, because, I mean, Europe does have the capacity of being much stronger than Russia's military, because Russia's trying to be just stronger than the next military. And of course, it's way stronger than any military, you know, individually in Europe, but not if everyone takes collective action. He also asked about, you know, could there be an insurgency in Russia? Well, yeah, eventually there could be, especially if Putin appears weak, which of course is what Putin's trying not to do. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of dissatisfaction with the war over time. Not immediately, but over time in the next several years and beyond, Russia will be weakened by this. It has a war economy, but eventually people's own prosperity and wealth will feel the pinch. It hasn't yet, but, you know, it will over time. You have got all these distortions in Russia because of the loss of so many men demographically and people going abroad to escape, you know, Putin's Russia. And eventually you'll, you know, have a real squeeze in your job market and also in innovation.
It can take a long time. I remember the Soviet Union was desperately poor, kept losing thousands of men in various wars, and it lasted more than 70 years.
And then it tipped. Mm-hmm. And that's the point of the systems like this that are very brittle. Things can happen very, very quickly. And Putin is not immortal. You may think he is. And maybe at this point, you know, he's done everything to make himself immortal, but he's just not. And, you know, things can happen very quickly.
The last bit of Derek's question was, and even if Russia loses in Ukraine, what is there to stop them rearming and coming back stronger and doing the whole thing again?
Well, that's the point that's tied to really the first part of his question about, you know, does Ukraine lose? Well, yes, it does if Europe doesn't step up.
Fair enough.
And so that gets back to what we were saying before. If Europe always looks like it's reliant on the United States, there's really nothing to stop Putin. I mean, we've basically got a big problem. We should worry.
Yeah.
We should worry. As I'm sitting here listening to you, you know what I'm taking solace in? That image of your dog, Lola, which we can see behind you through the glass door.
Looking out the window. Looking out the window,
peacefully.
Yes,
so
exactly.
That's a nice balance for me there.
Mm. Yeah, we have to rein in the dogs of war and turn them on into Lola.
Fiona, thank you so much for giving us your time here on Ukrainecast and for your incredible insight. We really, really appreciate it. It's been a privilege having you on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. I wish I had a little bit of more of an upbeat prognosis, but, you know, there's lots
that's
of things that we can do.
Yeah.
But there's lots of things we can do. Yeah. There really are.
I feel a bit depressed by Fiona's insight. I mean, she's laid it on the table. Europe's going to have to do even more. And you think about the military aid that Europe has given thus far. We're 2 years into this. We're now in the third year of this war. And it's not going to be over unless Europe...
Well, it's sobering.
Yeah, very sobering.
President Putin is emboldened. Mm. He will be even more emboldened after the quote-unquote election.
Yeah.
His main opponent is dead. His army is making gains in Ukraine. If Donald Trump wins in the States, it will make Putin's job in Ukraine easier, apparently.
Potentially, yeah.
Aid to Ukraine is stuck in the States already. So, yeah, difficult time for Ukraine.
Yeah. You know, I'm trying to find some optimism somewhere. As Fiona said, we can still do, we, as in Europe... Europe can still do a lot, and so it needs to. So thank you very much for listening to Ukrainecast, and I hope you appreciated Fiona's insight, as we certainly did, and wherever you are listening in the world, take care.
Goodbye.
Ukrainecast from BBC News.